Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for Women Over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Hi, and welcome. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40. Today is our first live show. I am joined by my intrepid producer, Mary Lou Cook, and my first guest, Dr. Jeremy Gaze, is a Florida-based clinical psychologist and family mediator and the co-author of the book Mindful Co-Parenting. He is a licensed psychologist and mediator. He's been doing this for over 25 years. We'll be talking about divorce, co-parenting, and a host of other related topics. So thank you so much to the listener for joining us live today. Dr. Gaze, welcome to our show.
Thanks, Sima. Excited to be here.
So let's start from the beginning. The term mindful co-parenting reminds me of the other term, conscious uncoupling, which was so widely popularized by Gwyneth Paltrow. And I'm wondering, what is mindful co-parenting all about, and did you coin the term?
Well, actually, we did coin the term, my co-author Jim Morris and I, but really the term is just a simple way of focusing parents in on their children's needs at the present time. So our definition of mindful co-parenting is paying attention to how your parent, your children, along with your children's other parent, day by day, moment by moment, and with a focus on what is in the long-term best interest of the kids.
And where did you come up with this idea? Was it as a result of the work that you've done?
Well, definitely. Both my co-author, Jim Morris, and I, we had been working for many years with families, mostly families going through divorce and in high conflict. So we would meet day by day with families, and we would talk to them and give them guidance and help them think through how they wanted to work together as a co-parenting team. We also had an interest in the work of mindfulness. Much of that work was popularized and really made more scientific by the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn.
Yes.
In the United States.
Yes.
And so we put these two concepts together. How do you work together as co-parents? And how do you do that in a mindful way? And that's where we came up with the idea of mindful co-parenting.
I really love this. So tell me a little bit more about how would you go about schooling someone to really take this approach? You know, when people get to this point, they're angry, they are bitter, there's resentment, there's shame, there's humiliation, and all of the emotions that are just the hardest to get out of your stomach, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So how would you start by counseling them to use this technique?
Sure. Well, the approach of mindful co-parenting is perhaps less counseling and more what we would consider consultation, meaning that we're typically working with parents together to help give them education, guidance, support, help them resolve disputes. We're not going so much into the nature of their interpersonal conflicts, why they got divorced, or what their feelings are toward the other parent on any issues other than parenting. We try to help folks really focus in on what kind of parent do they want to be, how can they work as a co-parenting team, and what can they do together to make sure that their children's interests are met. So you're absolutely right. There are a lot of emotions that come with divorce, and so we can't help but come across those. But what we try to do is try to shift people from a focus on their anger or their hurt or their loss or their frustration to the task ahead. And the task ahead is, how do we together raise this child or these children to have the very best outcome possible?
So I really want to explore this a little bit further. Can you take me inside a therapist's office, and there are two partners, and again, they're grappling with their own issues, their own anger, their disappointment, their rage. How would you set about doing this? Do you role play? Do you talk them through it? Please be more specific.
Absolutely. Well, the first step when I meet with parents who are going through a divorce or who are already divorced and are trying to improve their way of working together as co-parents is to meet with each of them individually. I find that to be exceptionally important because it's necessary for me to hear their separate stories and to be able to hear that without having anyone else in the room who might roll their eyes or disagree or argue or interrupt. And it's also important for them to be able to hear from me about these very concepts of mindful co-parenting and about the approach that we would use going forward to help them and their children. So we have this initial meeting, and I do it with each parent separately. And once I've met with them and I've established a certain level of rapport, even in that meeting, we then move forward to the first joint meeting. So at that first joint meeting, it really looks a little bit more like a business meeting than like a counseling session. Mm. And by that, I mean that we literally have a large whiteboard that we have set up in the room, and we start by creating an agenda. So I ask each parent, what are some of the issues that they feel it would be important to address to improve the situation for their children? And sometimes the parents come up with similar concerns, and sometimes they come up with very different ones. We make an outline of that agenda, and then we sit back for a moment, all three of us, the two parents and myself, and we try to consider what would be the best strategy in that meeting for addressing those agenda items. For example, if one of the agenda items is communication and communication problems, and I'll let you know that's one item that almost always comes up at the first meeting, it makes sense to start addressing that first before talking about some specific arrangement about the children and their extracurricular activities. Because if the parents aren't able to communicate, even in a session, then they're not going to be able to talk about and resolve any other issues. So we look at the agenda and we try to figure out what's the best strategy for addressing those items. And then we work item by item, hearing what each parent's perspective is on that issue and helping them find a path to agreement. This is where training as a mediator comes into play. And a mediator's job is not to tell people what to do, but simply to hear what they each have to say and help move them forward toward an agreement.
I really love this because you're really talking about creating something like a comprehensive co-parenting plan, which really would be the nuts and bolts of any kind of, you said it was like a business meeting. Well, it would be like the nuts and bolts of any business plan, correct?
That's absolutely right.
And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, how did you really get involved in this? Where is your passion for all of this? And can you tell me a little bit about your journey to get to this present incarnation?
Absolutely. I'll tell you about it. I'll even tell you a little story. So I was trained to be a clinical psychologist many years ago, and I was licensed here in Florida about 25 years ago, a little bit more. And I worked as your typical clinical psychologist for many years, doing evaluations, doing testing, and mostly doing therapy. Therapy with children, therapy with teenagers, therapy with adults, therapy with older adults. I worked an awful lot with couples, and I found that I really liked that work. I liked that dynamic of having two people in the room and helping them try to understand each other better and try to help them figure out what they want their next steps to be. Well, along the way, I received a phone call from a family law attorney, a divorce lawyer, and they said, would you be willing to work with this family that has a very high level of conflict? When we think of families with a very high level of conflict in divorce, if we're old enough, we think of the movie War of the Roses. But there are many other movies that have come along that have shown quite a bit of conflict between parents in custody situations. So my response to that attorney was, oh, gosh, no, that sounds like that would be awfully messy. I don't think that's for me. Well, a little time went by, and then all of a sudden I saw on my schedule a family that was indeed a very, very high conflict family. And they were referred through another attorney to deal with these custody matters. And I thought, you know what? I've got a lot of experience working with people, a lot of experience working with couples. Maybe I should not be so afraid. Maybe I should see if I can be helpful. I worked with that family, and I will tell you, to this day, they were probably one of the highest conflict families I've ever worked with. And we worked very hard. And at the end of the process, I thought to myself, you know, it wasn't so bad. In fact, that felt like I was pretty helpful. And so from that point on, when I would get calls to do this work, I would say yes. And I started to say yes more and more. And the more I said yes, the more folks I saw. And the more folks I saw, the more referrals I got, until it got to a point that I said, I think this is what I want to do all day, every day. And so I devoted my practice to peacemaking with families, parents who are going through a divorce and who need help to work on how they're going to work as a co-parenting team.
We're talking today with Dr. Jeremy Gaze, a Florida-based clinical psychologist and family mediator, and the co-author of the great book, Mindful Co-Parenting. I would guess that this kind of methodology is actually really important for people who are not even yet divorced or thinking about getting divorced, but for whom this type of conflict is a daily exercise in their lives. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. I mean, these same approaches are helpful for parents who are in conflict, but they do choose to stay together. So really, you can apply these same techniques to intact families as well as families going through a divorce. One chapter of our book, as you can imagine, a very early chapter in the book, is helping parents who are considering divorce think through the pros and cons for their family. And I think that's actually a very important chapter of the book. It's one that many families I work with really can't use at that point, because by the time they get to me, usually they're pretty far along the way in the process moving toward a divorce. But there are families who can read that, and then they can make a very conscious decision, what I would say is a very mindful decision, about whether divorce is right for them or right for them and their family at that time. You know, there are parents who read the book. They read not only that chapter, but they read the chapters about the effects of divorce on parents and the effects of divorce on children, and they decide they can work harder and that there's a chance of keeping the marriage intact and in a successful kind of way. So I'm pleased for those families who are able to accomplish that, but I also respect that for many families, staying together is just not an option. And for those families, everything else in the book becomes absolutely essential.
This is wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about divorce, and then let's move forward. Do you have a sense of what type of person gets divorced? Are there always external factors? Do you ever see repeated patterns in the people who come through your doorway?
You know, Sima, that's a really excellent question. I would say the answer is that there aren't any really distinct patterns. I mean, all kinds of people get divorced. Nice people and not such nice people. Rich people and not so rich people. People who have had happy marriages for a period of time and people who never really had a very good marriage from the very start. So we really do see a very diverse range of people who ultimately get to the place that they find that a divorce is necessary. But I can tell you this, the higher the level of conflict in a divorce, the more likely that one or both of the spouses have some kind of issues, either personality conditions or other mental health issues that impede their ability to work together in a relationship to achieve healthy intimacy and to resolve problems when they arise. So for families who have a lot of conflict, it's very common to see some of those kinds of traits. But for the average family going through a divorce, you know, it's just like all of us. We do the best we can, but sometimes we find out that it doesn't work. Sometimes, as you pointed out, it can be for external factors. The most common external factor, as I'm guessing your listeners would guess themselves, would be an affair. Affairs are very common, and sometimes couples can work through it, and sometimes they just can't. But there are other issues that get in the way, other external factors. Money becomes a big issue for many families, leading to disputes. Conflicts over child rearing can become an issue as well. Sometimes the influence or the input of in-laws or extended family becomes an obstacle. So there are all those external factors, but then there are the internal factors as well. Most people in our society want to be in love with their spouse, and they may have been in love with their spouse at one point, but being in love is not a condition that always lasts, for reasons I'm not sure any of us fully understand. And so many of the families I see come to me because at that point one spouse is no longer invested in the marriage. They're no longer in love with their partner, and they don't feel that they want to continue on, even for the sake of the children. Even if they believe that might be helpful, they decide that it's not workable. One of the things that we talk a lot about in the book and that we talk about in person as well is how do they make that decision based on their children. Some parents say, I will stay if it's in my children's best interest. But it's not always in the children's best interest to stay. And the main variable there is whether there is conflict or not. If parents are not particularly happy together, but they can keep their conflict very low, the outcomes for their children are probably about as good as they would be if the parents felt happier. But once the level of conflict goes up, the outcomes for children go down, regardless of whether the parents stay married or the parents divorce. So really, the level of conflict is the primary mediator in determining whether staying together or getting divorced is in the children's best interest.
As a therapist and a mediator, are there any circumstances in which you would suggest divorce or ways in which you would counsel against it?
Well, yes, there are. I mean, the primary factor that would come into play when any type of counselor, advisor, or consultant is involved is if there is abuse. So if there is domestic violence, and domestic violence doesn't just mean physical violence, it also can mean control or, in essence, domination of one spouse by another. When those issues can't be resolved, then I could never recommend that someone stay in an abusive situation, and I would have to advise them to look at alternatives. In some situations where spouses are simply incompatible, it just does not make sense for them to continue to try to fix something that was sort of broken from the start. This is something, unfortunately, I see in a certain percentage of the parents who come in to see me. Sometimes the parents were never married, and they had a child together. Sometimes it was, in fact, most of the times, it was not something that was planned. But now here they are. They're parents of this child, and they both love the child dearly. But these two people were never destined to be together. They never had any plan to be together. In those situations, you know, obviously they're not already married. But in other situations in which people did get married, but there was never really any true deep relationship between them, I would have to help them consider whether staying together makes sense for them and for their children.
I can't help but share with you that I feel very saddened about all this. It feels like so many people's lives and so much hurt and so much pain. I mean, it must be very difficult for you at stages in your career.
Well, you know, sometimes it's challenging. I'll certainly acknowledge that. But I need to share with you also perhaps the brighter side. So the brighter side is that when parents who are getting divorced decide that they want to put their children first, and they're willing to apply these techniques of mindful co-parenting, working together as a team, putting aside their personal conflicts, and really focusing on what the children need. When they do that, the outcomes for the children in divorce are actually pretty good. There's a lot of research that shows that if parents are willing to make the commitment to do the things that they can do as parents and as co-parents with each other, those children have equally good outcomes to children whose parents did not get divorced. So the point is, it's not the divorce per se, It's how the parents handle the divorce that determines their children's outcome. And this is really good news, because what it means is that if parents are committed to doing the best for their children can do well. And this is an important message that we give to parents, because we want them to understand the ball is in their court. They have a lot of control over what happens to the children that they love so dearly. And when people know that they have some control and some responsibility, they're often willing to do things they might not otherwise have done. And if both parents are willing to pull together, their children can come out very, very well.
We're talking today with Dr. Jeremy Gaze about the topic of mindful co-parenting. Let's get down to some very specific ways. So what's the most common misconception about divorce?
Okay, that's a really a great question to ask. What do you think the most common misconception is? How do you like that? I'm turning the tables on my interviewer.
That's okay. For any of us who've been married, I think that many of us think this through very long and hard at certain points. So I think that the most common misconception would be that the grass is greener on the other side. Would that be
okay.
true?
Okay. I think that's a very accurate misconception. And I think the idea is that if we were no longer married, my life will be so much better, so much easier. And that is sometimes true. Sometimes when the problems are between the two spouses, ending a marriage can free them from the conflict. It can take them out of the bind. Sometimes that's not true, however. People have sort of a fantasy of what it means to be single again, or to be divorced, to be unmarried. So I think that absolutely is one of the important misconceptions. I think there are a few other important misconceptions, and one of them is that divorce always ruins children. And this gets back to what we spoke about just a moment or two ago, and that is that divorce does not have to ruin children. And divorce does not even have to hinder children, as long as the parents are willing to do what it takes to work together and invest themselves in working as a team. It's very hard for two separate people who aren't willing to work together to lead to a good outcome for children.
Sure.
Because children have one family. You know, you can say, well, when you're at my house, this is your family, and when you're in the other house, this is your family. But that's not how kids see it. Kids see it as the people who love me are my family. And
sure.
The people who love me may be mom, may be dad, may be dad's girlfriend, may be mom's new husband who's my stepfather. It may be my step-siblings. It may be my grandparents or my step-grandparents. All of those people become the child's family. So one of the things that we do to help parents understand that divorce doesn't have to ruin children is to help them recognize who is in the child's family and for them to do the best they can to embrace that.
So
there's another misconception I just want to add in
sure.
there, and that is that parents often feel that they don't really have to work at it. You know, this is like the same misconception that comes with marriage. You know, we're married, we shouldn't have to work at it. If we have to work at it, then there's something wrong. Well, we know that's not true with marriage. With marriage, it takes a lot of work. So does divorce. It's not like you just sign the divorce papers and you're done. If you have children, you still have a job to do, and you have a job to do for many years to come.
So if I'm going back to your comprehensive co-parenting plan, and now here come those step-parents and the step-grandparents and the step-siblings, where do you put them in the mix? Do they actually have to join you in the mediation sessions? And what happens if the step-parent, for example, really doesn't agree with the biological or the same parent or the partner parent approach? Now what do you do?
Great question. So first I want to start by saying that I think step-parents and step-families can add a tremendous amount to the quality of a child's life. And we should never look at step-parents or step-siblings or step-grandparents or step-aunts and uncles as being sort of to the side and unimportant. They are very important, and they play very significant roles. That said, we look at the primary parents, okay, which may be biological parents or may be adoptive parents, but the primary parents as primary, meaning the focus of the work is to help them work together, because if they can work together, each parent is typically able to help bring the step-parent into the fold. It is important, though, to note that sometimes a step-parent plays a role, either a very helpful role or sometimes a very destructive role, in the very relationship between the two parents. So we need to be very mindful of that. We need to be very alert to that. And there are certainly cases in which we need to invite a step-parent in so that we can talk with them, we can work with them. On rare occasions, we might even have a joint meeting where both parents and both step-parents are included. But we generally don't do a lot of that. And the reason we don't do a lot of that is that while it sounds like that could go really well, and it could go really well, when you've got four people in the room who are not seeing things eye to eye, there's a lot of potential for things to go awry. So we tend to focus more on getting the primary parents on the same page and then working through them to help get the step-parents where we would like them to be on behalf of the children.
So we're running out of time now, but I don't want to give up one most important thing. So many people have their own demons. So many people have their own issues for which they haven't worked through. Very quickly, what happens then? Because it becomes a more muddied water, correct?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, you know, you were right at the beginning of our conversation today. You spoke a little bit about this, about the stuff that people bring in. And a lot of times people do bring in demons, baggage, all kinds of stuff. When we work together with co-parents, we are in a neutral role. We are impartial. So we have to make sure we always stay in that role. And we're also in a specific role, in essence, as a consultant, not as a therapist, not as an evaluator. So we can certainly give some initial guidance to parents if they have these issues. But in most cases, if we see that a parent is really struggling, we want to bring in some extra resources. So we might talk to them about seeing a counselor. They may already have a counselor, and we may talk about things that they could work on with that counselor to get to a better place in their co-parenting. We do what we need to do to help coordinate the care. But when it comes to actually doing the counseling or therapy, we generally will help bring in another professional.
Sure. Last thing, what would you like to leave a listener with today?
A final thought is, if you are a listener who is thinking about divorce, struggling with divorce, in the middle of divorce, or dealing with the aftermath of divorce, and you have children, keep hope, because there are things you can do even if your co-parent won't do them. There are things that you can do to help protect your children and get them to the best place. I always encourage people to reach out. The best way to reach out is to go online, look at resources under co-parenting. Another great thing to do is get a few books. Don't get one book. Get several books on co-parenting in divorce. You can go to your local library. You can go on Amazon and look them up. Our book is a good starter book because it's written really to cover all of these concerns. And it's called Mindful Co-Parenting, A Child-Friendly Path Through Divorce.
We've been talking today with clinical psychologist and family mediator Dr. Jeremy Gaze about mindful co-parenting, and his book, Mindful Co-Parenting, can be found on Amazon. Thank you so much, Dr. Gaze, for joining us. You are our first live guest. We are honored.
Thank you so much, Emma.
To the listener, thank you for listening with us today. We'll join you next week again. I'm Sima Shapiro, your host of For Women Over 40.